This week on the podcast, we add one of the best RPGs of all time to the endless list. It's Chrono Trigger on It's So Bad.
Hello.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Google Podcasts, I think it's called now. I think they changed it.
Google.
Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts from. We are adding this week another best of all time game to our endless list, as chosen by Chris. It's Chrono Trigger. The game that was brought to us by Square in 1995 from the Dream Team. Do you know who the Dream Team is, Chris?
Not by name. I know you're but I didn't give it the
name. Hironobu Sakaguchi, the creator of Final Fantasy, Yuji Horii, the creator of Dragon Quest, and Akira Toriyama, the creator and animator for Dragon Ball. The three people came together to make this tremendous achievement in video games known as Chrono Trigger. Steve, you played a bit of this game.
That's right. I played about half of this game so far.
Okay. And Chris, how many times have you played this game?
I would think it'd be fair to say about 10 times, maybe a little less.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's granted, from 1995 to present, very spread out and, looking for JRPGs to play, sometimes go back to the old favorites. Like, when we did Final Fantasy IV, like, that's a game I've probably beaten, 30 times through. So,
right.
Yeah. 10, that's fair.
We are adding this game this week to our endless list. If you don't know what our endless list is, it is our list of the best games of all time, but also the worst games of all time. Everything in between, it currently has 97 entries on it. This is our 98th, as is. It goes from Super Mario 64 all the way down to Jurassic Trespasser at number 97. We are judging these games on their merits, how good they are, if they hold up, if the gameplay is good, if the soundtrack is good, if the story is good, if it has a history, if it has a legacy, etc., etc., etc. We judge all of these factors when we talk about these games and add them to our list. But first, let's talk about this game a little bit. So it came out in March of 1995, same year as Donkey Kong Country 2, Warcraft 2, Yoshi's Island, Command & Conquer, some of the big games from 1995. I think 1995 was the year also that the PS1 launched, so it was right in the midst of that transition into the 3D era, with N64 coming not far behind in September of 1996. But yeah, this game was kind of like towards the end of the Super Nintendo, where it originally launched, Super Nintendo library, the last year where it had big releases on it. And it was kind of like the peak of the Super Nintendo RPGs, which Super Nintendo was known for its RPGs, with your Final Fantasy IV, your Final Fantasy VI, your Breath of Fires. What other RPGs are on the Super Nintendo, Chris?
Lufia or Lufa? I forget which it is. Lufia.
Mother.
Earthbound.
Secret of Mana.
I was gonna say ActRaiser if you count those. They're kind of more like action RPGs, I guess I would say. Right. But then you had some real clunkers on there. What's the one with like the old guy playing the banjo on it on the cover on the Western release?
Isn't that a
Completely different?
Yeah, it's a shooter. That's
is that a shooter?
I thought it was Phalanx. It's Phalanx. Yeah.
Well, whatever. There's like some really terrible like kind of quasi 3D open world RPG that I'm thinking of that I feel like everybody probably rented at some point from Blockbuster, and probably played for about 5 minutes and brought back. I can't recall what the name of it is off the top of my head, but I'll find it when this podcast ends, and we'll all be like, oh, yes, I know that game.
Yeah, Final Fantasy Mystic Quest was my first ever RPG as well, and that was on Super Nintendo. I've since gone on to play a lot of these Super Nintendo RPGs and a lot of RPGs just in general.
I guess Mystic Quest did its job then, because that was supposed to get people into RPGs. So
yeah,
worked on you.
That was the original idea. But this game, so I talked about the Dream Team, the people who made JRPGs into what JRPGs are, which is Sakaguchi and Hori, the creators of Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, come together. And they're like the biggest series in Japan, like just in video games in general. Both of those series are like humongous in Japan. So for these two to come together, along with Akira Toriyama, who created Dragon Ball, which is probably the biggest manga and anime at the time in Japan, was like a huge deal. And for it to be successful is even more crazy. I think Sakaguchi and somebody else, and Toriyama, and some other people came together for another game later on. I think it was called Blue Dragon for the Xbox 360, mm-hmm. and it was nowhere near as popular as this game, and it didn't do as well. So when you see super groups of like music and stuff, it never usually goes as well as this.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. Like I was gonna say, like doing the research on this, I was like, it feels like this is a super group, and so often those do not go well. And you could almost like, I was watching some videos about this game before we got on the pod, and like they were talking about some of the composer, I forgot his name,
Nobuo Uematsu, but he wasn't like the main one. He like had to come in and help out because the actual composer I think was got sick at some point or had some sort of personal
that's
issue.
What I was gonna say.
Yeah,
he like, it seems like he like worked himself into sickness basically because he was so concerned about like nailing this, and it's like this was one of those passion projects where like they were so excited and they were like, we're the best, let's put it all together, but also then like the stakes have never been higher and we have to deliver the goods on this too.
So
it's amazing.
He's the Final Fantasy composer.
Yeah, Nobuo Uematsu, is the Final Fantasy composer. The guy who's the main credit for this game is Yasunori Mitsuda, and he's the guy who would go on to work on the Zeno series. So he did all of the music for Gears, Chronicles 1 and 2, Saga, still making music. But this was his first big like piece, and he went up to, I guess, Uematsu before when this game was being created, and he's like, either let me create the music for this game or I'm quitting, because he was like his like protege at the time. So so Mitsuda got a start here. He's done a ton of shit, but the Zeno series is kind of what he's best known for. Then there's other people who are even like big names in the industry. Masato Kato, he is was the story planner behind Ninja Gaiden, and he was a writer on this game. There's like a bunch of more people who were big names in the Japanese industry who joined this team to put this game
together. I think close to 40-person development team, and it was like something like a dozen of them went on to be directors on video games, like specifically. Like it's wild.
And there's like, and also at the time period, like it was like a double the size of what a usual development team was for the time period. Because I think development teams at that time period were like 20 to 25 people, and this was like 45 people were in the development team.
Oh, I thought it was less, but I thought it was still like 37 to 40. But yeah, I mean, still big.
It was big. So this game also was originally planned to be a Seiken Densetsu game. I don't know if you knew that, but that's a Secret of Mana game. But they changed it over to be its own thing when they started to develop it. It was also supposed to be on the Nintendo's Super Nintendo CD system, but since that never came to fruition, they made it into a cartridge game, and it ended up being at the time of release the biggest cartridge they ever made, and it was the most expensive game to buy at the time it was released.
I don't know if you, well, speaking of the Secret of Mana connection, I don't know if you found anything related to this, because I was trying to find some of this as to why Chrono kind of resembles the player character in Secret of Mana, because they are kind of similar looking characters. I don't know if that's just the Dragon Ball guy like designing both or whatever, but you know, I wonder if that was like a holdover or whatnot from like it originally being part of Secret of Mana or whatnot. But I don't know. I couldn't find a reason as to why he so closely resembles the player character sprite in Secret of Mana. I'm not sure if you did.
You're probably right. It was probably because it was originally supposed to be a Seiken Densetsu game, but it also is very evocative of the way Akira Toriyama draws his characters just in general with the big hair.
Spiky hair and sword? Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing with him is, it's kind of wild to think about it at the time, but Chrono is originally designed with a sword, not with a sword, with a katana. And that was very different for the time period because there weren't a lot of sword or katana wielding JRPG heroes before this game. They were all really sword and like fantasy type people, like medieval fantasy, European, and not evocative of an Asian perspective, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, this game, it came out really well. But what is this game? Chris, do you want to talk about the story a little bit?
Yes, it's hard to kind of nutshell the story. I mean, it is kind of hard to nutshell the story because it, in very Doctor Who fashion, it goes through time and space to kind of get us to where the end is. But essentially, you play Chrono, who is I would call him a silent protagonist, but he's clearly having dialogue exchanges with the people that he's interacting with, which I want to make that distinction because I feel like a lot of times when, like in Dragon Quest, when you're a silent protagonist, I feel like you know, you don't really get the sense that you're that protagonist is having conversations with people, but clearly there's a personality that is being absorbed by the characters around. At least that's how I took it.
I don't see that at all, by the way.
Chris, I found it. I agree with that take that he's definitely talking with people there because everyone responds to him. It's like, oh, you sound like you want to do this.
Well, so where I was but leading I thought it to was... with that is because he clearly develops a love interest with Marley, who is a runaway queen who is or. Princess who is forsaking her royal upbringing, and they have a chance meeting at a fair, which then leads them into a zany time travel adventure to prevent Lavos from destroying the planet in 1999. The distant, distant year of 1999.
1,000 years in the future.
They're in the year 1,000 AD, right. Or whatever.
Right.
Whatever
right.
The equivalent so, is. I don't want to let you off the hook with this. I don't want to let you off the hook with the silent protagonist thing, though, because I thought it was so funny that you've been like, I'm not a silent protagonist guy. And then here you bring us.
I was going to say, like, I think there is a testament to this game about how much I enjoy it that I did recommend it for this, because I have been very, very vocal about hating silent protagonists. And I do feel like I don't have many negative things to say about this game. I do feel like, though, that if Chrono was a character that actually had written dialogue and that was portrayed with the characters, I think that to me would take this from like a 9 out of 10 to a 10 out of 10.
So this game isn't a 10 out of 10 for you?
Not for me personally, but I mean, there is no game that we have currently discussed on the Endless List that to me is a 10 out of 10. So I will say, I'll put that disclaimer. I'm still chasing that perfect game, Mike, but I think this is as close as one can get, and I think the simple fact that Chrono does not actually have dialogue outside of one ending, he has dialogue.
He has a dialogue and an ending? Is it the ending with the directors?
Yes. No, it's it's an ending where Marley, Luca, and Isla are sitting around and they're talking about all the male characters in the game and they're kind of like ranking them on looks, and he comes in and has one line of dialogue in the whole thing. And that's his only quote-unquote spoken lines in the entire game.
So two things. The silent protagonist thing, I think, is imported from Yuji Horii in the Dragon Quest series. So the thing that you hate about the Dragon Quest series, it's directly from... That's the reason why it's in this game. But also, I want to say it's Marley, but it's Marl.
I read it as Marl every time, but then I like went down a deep internet hole trying to figure out the correct pronunciation, and this guy made a very convincing case that it was Marley instead. But I still say Marl every time.
Okay. Well, whenever I've heard it in any criticism or whenever anybody talks about it, it's Marl. But I want to say Marley because Marley just makes way more sense.
I'm going to call Marl. I mean, like
pretty much every.
Yeah.
Every time I read her name, I would do this thing in my brain where I'd be like, it's supposed to be Marley, but it's Marl. And I would just say Marl in my brain every time.
My concern so is this podcast... with my, I was going to say, my concern with my accent, I'm going to end up calling her like Merle the entire time. So I'm trying to avoid doing that.
A lot of this podcast is informed by me reading a lot different things, but I'll, Michael P. Williams' Boss Fight books, Chrono Trigger book, which I'll shout out here. He has some interviews with the people who did the localization of this, and it's interesting on the naming conventions. One of the things they talked about in the book was in Final Fantasy VI, the main protagonist that we know is named Terra. And the reason why she's named Terra is because in Japanese, she was named Tina, and they wanted to exoticize it. And that's in Japanese, American names and English names are exotic. So they don't have, they can use names that we're familiar with. So over when they transfer it over here, they want to re-exoticize it. So they change Tina to Terra. And I'm thinking the same thing probably happened with Marl and Marley or whatever, where they, you know, they change it to make it sound more exotic and more adventurous. The localization is super interesting, by the way, to me at least.
We may never know the answer, I guess. It's up for debate.
But speaking of localization, Lavos is the big enemy. He is this big space monster that comes down, and he isn't even introduced until a few hours into the game. Originally, when I played this game, so I played this game for the first time a few years back, but I replayed it for this podcast a second time, and... it was weird to me that, you know, they set up Magus to be the big bad guy. And I guess this is just a JRPG trope where they set up this big bad guy and then there's this even bigger bad guy. But Lavos is in it in the first couple hours. He is a big spiky ball that comes down from space and is going to cause the end of the world in the year 1999. And your job is to defeat it. Originally in the game... Ayala, when he comes down and he hits Earth and he destroys Azela's fortress, the Reptite, she says that she names it Lavos, which means big fire. That's what they say in the game. But supposedly, in reading up on the localization, the Japanese is Ravosu, because they R and the L are the same letter in Japanese for people who don't know. And Ravosu is supposed to come from... Rovu Kurafuto, which is the transliteration, the English or the Japanese transliteration of Lovecraft. So this is supposed to be like a Lovecraftian horror that comes down from space.
Oh, the cosmic horror, like the god alien.
Horror. Yeah,
yeah.
That's cool. I didn't realize that. That's very interesting.
So yeah, so you go in between time periods. You start off in 1000 AD. Chrono walks, wakes up in bed, and then he goes to the fair where he gets transported, or where Marl gets transported back to 600 AD. There's like time paradoxes in this game, like Princess Lean in 600 AD, who's Marl's descendant. She gets captured and people don't know where her whereabouts are. So Marl just kind of disappears because she doesn't exist anymore until you save Lean, which is funny to me.
It's a little bit of a Marty McFly thing. He's like looking, he's like looking at the picture and he's like, oh,
well,
there's also, Chuck Berry.
There's another part too where you send Robo back in time to fix a forest and you can. Yeah. Go right. on and get Robo back, and he's still back in time fixing the forest. And then when you go into the future, he's a rusted robot that you have to reawaken.
Repair. Yeah, yeah. There's so much. I feel like
it's
there's
very
so much
Futurama.
Kind of like there, yeah, but it's like I feel like there's a lot to unbundle, or at least kind of talk about with like the story and how you kind of move through time and space. Well, just time. I got to stop saying time and space. That's watching too much Doctor Who right there. But you're moving through time, and it's like. The those like little details like that kind of change as you kind of venture forward into the future, then back into the past and further into the future. I think what I like, a thing that I really liked about this game was like it felt like a much more living, breathing world for a 16-bit era RPG. You know, it's like you play, like, as much as I love like Final Fantasy IV or Final Fantasy VI, you go into the same inn or tavern, you know, 10 times in the game, the dialogue is going to stay the same. As you're doing different things throughout this game, like those little random NPC characters that don't further any side quests, that don't really have anything to really do with the main story, like, it's always evolving, always changing. And, you know, I think that's a very, like, submersive feature to this game that, just one of the many things that, you know, I could go on and say how much I like about this game. But as you were touching on, like, the time travel issues, I wanted to kind of highlight that as like, a little detail that I might not fit into the conversation as we go.
Well, it's also pretty cool, too, that the land masses stay the same pretty much throughout all the time periods. And you just see how civilization evolves over time, right? Mm-hmm. So you go back in time at one point to 65 million BC, to like your super ancestors, essentially. And you help them defeat the Reptites, who are this other race that exists on this planet. And if you don't do that, then if you fight Lavos and you beat them before you beat, because you can beat the main bad guy at any point in this game. Once you get to a certain point, you can essentially defeat Lavos whenever you want. It's not something you can do outside of New Game Plus a lot of the time, but you can. Right. In the game, you can defeat Lavos, the final boss, at pretty much any moment after a few hours into the game. But if you defeat
you can
Lavos,
finish your. I was gonna say you can finish your first playthrough by defeating Lavos by skipping the Black Omen. Like
right.
That is achievable. Yeah.
Right.
But yes, but the other endings you need to get is a New Game Plus.
Right. So there's one ending you can get where. If you don't defeat the Reptites in 65 million BC, then the Reptites are the main people on the planet. So yeah, you going back in time is the reason why the humans are the dominant species on the planet, is what essentially what that says.
Whoa, it already happened? Whoa,
yeah,
timey-wimey.
Everybody became Jurassic Park Trespasser in the future. That's what happens.
So, yeah.
There's also different endings you can get that, sorry, Steve, I don't know if you got this far, but
I'm on the podcast.
If you don't bring Chrono back to life after Lavos kills him, you can get a whole slew of different endings, too, that don't involve Chrono, because you complete the game without the main character, if you want.
A little fun tidbit that I picked up doing research for this is apparently the original version of this game was supposed to have Chrono dead at the very, very beginning the whole time.
Oh.
And then you were supposed to, like, go back and replay all the game, but, like, in the future he died fighting Lavos. And the Square pushed back on it and was like, no, that's too depressing. It's going to put, like, kind of, like, a morbid tone over the whole game then. So they axed that part of it.
The original idea was not to... So what you do in the actual game is, like, you get a... It's so ridiculous, but like you go to the the House of Horrors carnival game at the fair, and you get a Chrono duplicate robot, and then you get the Chrono Trigger. The namesake of the game is essentially a MacGuffin in this game. It's basically like the briefcase from Pulp Fiction. It doesn't like really mean anything, but it gives you something to chase after. And like you use that to go back in time and replace Chrono at the moment that he's about to be killed by Lavos with the dummy. And then, you know, whatever, Chrono's revived was the original, or one of the several original ideas was, like, Chrono gets killed, you go further back in time, get a healthy Chronos, and basically just have him skip over that moment, and then let him keep living. Like, that was too dark.
No, the idea behind that ending, and I read about that, or that what they wanted to do there is, they wanted him to die, and then you go back in time, get a healthy one, but he's always going to die. Because right. You return him to that moment. So that's super dark.
I don't want my spiky-haired protagonist boys to die, even if they don't say anything. I don't want that.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, this game jumps around between various different time periods. At one point, you go to 2300 AD, which is in, like, a post-apocalypse wasteland where humans are hiding in these, like, shelters, and there are mutants in junkyards, and robots are gonna come and kill you, and it's, like, for a Super Nintendo game to do this kind of stuff is... It's crazy. And again, on the map, all of these locations are in the same spots that they are in all the different time periods. Right. So that you just see how human civilization has evolved in the society over the course of time.
I was so impressed playing this game, like how sophisticated it is for like Super Nintendo 1995 era, like the animations, the world building, like going back and forth in time. Like Chris, what you were saying, like you revisit the same locations, but like time still passes. Like at the part of the game that I left off, you know, you go into the past to like the medieval area initially, you go through this whole like chain of events, you go into the future, then you end up back in your present day where you start, and then you go back to the past again. And like you go into the castle and they're like, oh, you again, hey, what are you up to? And like time has passed there, but it's like it's kind of like open world RPG, but in SNES. Yeah. But at the same time, it's very streamlined, and like I don't want to say it's like you're not like on a rail necessarily, but like the story is pushing you along where it wants you to go.
Yeah, it for a Super Nintendo game, the progression is very good. Like there is if you talk to people, you will find out what you need to do next pretty easily. So it's not cryptic at all. It's like for me, Nintendo games, original NES games, were very, very cryptic. And then Super Nintendo was a time period where they started to get away from that. And I think that has a lot to do with localization efforts, because they actually, instead of having somebody who was a native Japanese speaker who didn't really know what they were doing, try to translate a game, they brought in people specifically to do that task. And I think that made it a lot better, especially with JRPG games. But this game in particular, it really guides you along in terms of story. And also in terms of the actual combat, there's like no need to grind in this game. You can make it from beginning to end without really grinding. And that's a function in JRPGs that they rely on so much grinding. Usually.
That is what has like kept me out of so many JRPGs, and like what immediately like brought me into this game, because I hate grinding. It is my least favorite thing in any video game. Like I just don't and especially random encounters too. Like this kind of like takes what I see to be like the sins of excess for JRPGs, and just is like, no, it's still in there. Like you can have random encounters if you want. Like the same enemies will pop up every time you leave an area and come back, but it gives you the out to like avoid those fights if you want.
Right.
And you don't have to grind. Like you probably should fight people as you go through an area as they pop up to level up your characters, but you don't need to necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like you can get that experience back in other ways.
And to that point, like enemies only respawn in certain areas, like almost as like a clue that like you should probably grind here. But like for the most part, when you're going through certain dungeons, like the enemies don't come back. Like after you've kind of cleared a room. Not all the time, but sometimes. But I think, you know, Mike, kind of what you were kind of touching on is that like the crypticness in the battle system, right? Like that's, you know, just like you guys were just saying, those are two things that keep people away from JRPGs, and they remove those barriers, not in a way that made the game easier, but in a way that made the game like more accessible to so many more people, right? It's like there is a lot of crypticness to this game, but it's not in the main story, it's in the side stuff.
Yeah.
And like the mystery stuff you go to unravel and unfold. And I think that's like in what makes this game so fun, is like you can get through the main story without too much mystery, without too much going like, all right, I gotta get open a strategy guide if you're in 1995 or your Game Pro magazine or whatever you were reading, or like now like looking up a walkthrough. But like you don't have to worry about any of that until like you want to do like the really deep cryptic side quest stuff that doesn't really have, like, it has an impact on the story, it fleshes the characters out more, but also the combat, like, you know, it's not even turn-based entirely. It's kind of like a quasi-turn-based kind of real-time thing going on.
Yeah, it's
like, now you're hitting on like my favorite part of this game, like the combat system, like the blend of turn-based and real-time, where you like the combat animations too, where you like get into a fight and your character's all spread out and the enemies come in, and then you have like a little bit of a timer on each of them. There's like a bar that has to fill up until you can attack again, and then you're managing all your stats, like you have your mana or whatever they call it, and your health, and so you're like keeping an eye on that. But you're like, you're setting up an attack, but you have to wait for your bar to fill back up before you can mm-hmm. attack. And then the enemy will attack you too. And it's like, you know, you're picking your moves as you go along and switching between your three different characters, but it's happening semi in real time, which is mm-hmm. like just so cool. And then like you do those technical attacks too, where your characters combine, and it's like one person can throw fire and Chrono has a sword, and so he's going to spin his sword around and like shoot fire everywhere. Or there's a healing beam and the robot's going to shoot a beam of healing light at everybody, and like your party like heals up. It's so cool. It looks so
good. And you get the, as the game goes on, like, you know, like, it's funny because, like, this game does so many things that I don't traditionally like in JRPGs, especially as being, like, the JRPG guy in this podcast, but, like, it just does them in the way I think they should be done. Like, I don't like it when you have, like, half a dozen characters to choose from to make a party. I like it when you kind of have a defined party that's going to experience the story as you go. But this game does it in such a way where it's like you don't just use the same three characters over and over again, because it entices you to swap your party out because you unlock those dual techs and then those triple techs.
No, and like, but even parts of the story too are like, this game is set up into like episode structures. If you save, mm-hmm. you see the episode, and each episode typically has either one or two party members that have to be in that episode. And if there's extra people, typically, well, until the end of the game when it gets a little muddled, but typically the other person's like, there's a story reason why they're not in your party.
Exactly.
So
right.
Like,
yeah.
So like somebody's holding a door open to make sure that you guys can get back out, because you need to keep Robo and somebody else in your party. And I think that adds to it.
There's definitely some chapters of the game that read a little bit better with certain characters in your party, you know, like having Frog in your party, like especially anytime you're doing anything that involves Magus, like having Frog in your party is going to make the dialogue and the interaction like a lot better. Especially when you like,
go ahead, finish.
No, that was it.
I was just going to say, when I saw the cover art for this game before I played it, and I saw that there was a frog character, I was like, what the fuck is this game? Why is there a frog and a robot and a cave woman and like the typical pointy-haired JRPG hero here? And then I met Frog in that first like Back to the Future, or Back to the Past, I guess, episode, where he's like this dutiful, chivalrous knight character. And I was like, yo, Frog is awesome. Yo, this is sweet.
Frog is legit.
Frog is legit. And then he leaves your party, and I'm just like, when's Frog coming back? I know he's coming back at some point. I want to get back to him. So I've brought Robo into the past with me, but at some point I'm like, I can't wait till Frog gets back in this party.
Frog Frog is one of the best JRPG characters of all time.
Yeah.
So. And I just thought he looked so ridiculous on the cover, and now I'm like, I'm all about Frog. Team Frog.
His story arc with like Magus too, and then like especially if like you choose to like spare Magus and like have him join your party, it's like a really like impactful thing. It's like, you know, you take this little frog character who's speaking this, at least in the westernized version, he really develops the old-timey English and stuff like that, and he's just like filled with so much like anger and hatred. And then it's like when you play the game in such a way that you spare Magus, and it's like him just having to come to terms with the fact that like his friend's never gonna come back, and killing Magus isn't going to solve anything, and him like watching him kind of like let that go away, and then Magus going like, all right, well, you know, we're actually both fighting the same enemy, even though I kind of went about it in a real dickhead way. Like, you know, I'm going to come with you guys now. I wish that was explored a little bit more after that, because it kind of drops off. But, but still, I think that arc, though, is great.
But if you don't kill Magus, so Magus is an optional character. He's a boss that can join your party, and he's very strong magical attacks. If you don't kill Magus, Frog doesn't become a man at the end of the game.
Right.
So if you kill Magus, then Frog turns back into Glenn at the end of the game.
Yeah, Magus is awesome.
I had a feeling Frog was actually a person.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty much like a whole part of this. Like, so Magus kills Cyrus. Glenn is Frog's actual name. Okay. And so like they confront Magus at some point during the war against the Demon King, because he's the Demon King or whatever they call him, and after Magus kills Cyrus, he doesn't kill Glenn slash Frog. He turns him into a frog instead. But Magus kind of interesting because, like, his whole, like, purpose as you play throughout the game is that he is trying to prevent Lavos from ever existing. He's trying to summon him in the past to kill him when he's still weak. And then also trying to, like, avenge, and, like, also motivated by avenging his sister who has been, like, consumed by Lavos, which will perhaps play a little bit more into a future game. But
you don't know that she's consumed by Lavos, do you, in this game? I think that's only in Chrono Cross.
I think I got a little twisted with that because, like I was saying, when I was replaying it for the podcast, I played the DS port, which that there is a bonus chapter at the end of the game that is all about Sharla getting consumed by Lavos and Magus confronting Lavos and taking Magus back to the beginning of his story arc, back to the ancient, not pre-Sargar, but the medieval times.
Yeah. So what happens, I believe, is that Magus is from like 12,000 BC, which is like a time
period.
There was a time period before the modern time period in this game where there was like magic and all this other wild shit and people were floating in on rocks in outer space and there was all kinds of magic powered everything. And they awakened Lavos in that time period, and that's when he got hurled back to 65 million BC, where he met Ozzy, and Ozzy became his mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Ozzy's a reptile.
Ozzy, Flea, and Slash, but in the Japanese version, they're named after soy sauce, mayo, and vinegar, which I think is...
Beniga, soy sauce, and mayone. Do you know why they're named after food?
No, I just know they were.
So Toriyama is famous for, the Dragon Ball guy is famous for food puns. Goku, Gohan, Vegeta, who else? Everything is a food pun. All the names of Dragon Ball characters are food puns.
Biggs and Wedge also got a cameo in this game as well. Yeah.
The Final Fantasy crossover there. Yes.
Yeah, with the Star Wars crossover. Yeah.
Right.
Oh my god, they're in... I think they're in the Magus era in the medieval times. I think there's two soldiers that are references Biggs and Wedge. I think it might be Dix and Wedge, but they're supposed to be Biggs and Wedge.
Yeah. Also, Magus is named Giannis when he's in 12,000 BC, the Roman deity who has two faces, one towards light and one towards dark. So they're like, here, let me hit you over the head. There's also some other...
Just like the villain from GoldenEye. Is there a GoldenEye tie-in here?
Right.
He's a Cossack.
There was also another thing, too. Robo's real name is Prometheus in the future. And he's brought back to life by Luca, whose element is fire. So.
That makes sense. Mm. Interesting.
I didn't connect that.
Little Greek mythology, a little Roman mythology, little sushi mythology. You know, it all comes together.
I feel like Robo also has like a very like kind of, not to like dwell on it too much, but like he, you know, I think Robo's arc is also like a very kind of sad arc as well because he was built to, you know, essentially spy on humans and essentially figure out a better way to exterminate humans for the robots. And then he kind of, through his bond with Luca, like kind of denies that program. And actually kills his own girlfriend, his own robot girlfriend later in the game.
Well, he kills her, but he brings her back at the very end.
Yes.
But yeah, Robo has a bunch of shit. Like he has the whole thing with his girlfriend. He has the, they send him back in time to remake the forest. And he's a great character.
Little note on this before we move on. I like how in this game, every time you meet a new character, well, I don't know if it's every time you meet a new character, but they give you the option to name them if you want. And the option for the robot and the frog is Frog and Robo. And Robo. I just enjoyed that every time. I was like, oh, I wonder what this character's name is. Oh, it's Frog. Oh, I wonder what this character's name is. Oh, it's Robo.
Really on the nose there.
Yeah, okay. But I kept it. I'm a big believer in that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So yeah, any other story beats we want to talk about in this game?
Oh, Luca and her mother? I don't think, yeah, I don't think Steve got this far, but...
Nope, don't know about this yet.
So Steve, you reach a point in this game where basically the ending is has come, right? There's this big thing that appears called the Black Omen, and you can either go there and do some things, which is kill this Queen Zeal, who's like this person who wants to help and who wants to help Lavos destroy the world, and is Magus's mom, or you can just go to Lavos in 1999 and just directly fight him or it, or you can go and do a bunch of side quests, so you can go anywhere you want at any time at the end of this game. And so there are like 8-9 different side quests, and each of them...
There's essentially one for every character, basically.
Yeah, and each of them provides you with either armor, or they're like the person's ultimate weapon when you do them. And so there's like one where you have to do this convoluted thing and go to each time period to check on this egg, or not at this egg, check on this the stone to see if it changes in a cave. And like, that's super convoluted. There's one about a shell that's, for some reason, the king stole it, but it's his own heirloom and it's underneath the castle. And there's a whole trial and you bust through a stained glass window, and that's pretty cool. I like that one.
That's right. There are two trials in this game, which is fantastic.
I was going to say, I thought I experienced the trial, but I see there's a second one.
There's a second trial, and it's so good, and there's a chancellor that's actually a demon who's kidnapped the real chancellor. Steve, the side quests get really wild, and they're so good.
But also...
and they're like, all short. They're all short. They're all like about an hour.
There's a shell, right? The rainbow shell. That supposedly the king has stolen and he's on trial for, but it's his own heirloom. So how could he steal his own heirloom? I don't understand that concept.
Time travel, man. So, you know, who knows?
Well, I think there's something about when the royal family gets swapped out by the demons. I think there's a lapse in like what happens to the rainbow shell there. That's what I think it is.
But yeah, you were talking about Luca's mom.
Yes. So a big thing that hangs over Luca's head is that when Luca was a child, and hence why she became so fascinated with technology and, I was going to say robotics, but, well, I guess whatever. She builds a time travel gate, so I guess we'll call it.
Yeah, I mean, she may not have
developed it. Robotics and engineering, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know, different path.
So there was an accident when she was a child involving her mother, where her mother's legs got caught in a machine that was in their home, and she didn't know how to like save her from the machine. And like, as like you play throughout the game, like Luca talks about the guilt of like not being able to save her mother lives. She's just paralyzed, but like not being able to save her mother. And you get the chance to undo that history, towards the end of the game. And it's like, I succeeded in saving.
I fucked it up. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I was like, and I just watched her get paralyzed because she's like on a conveyor belt and you have to stop the conveyor belt from her getting to the end, and you have to like input the sequence, and it didn't occur to me what the sequence was. So I just watched her get paralyzed again.
I could be wrong, but I think the canonical ending is actually that she doesn't save her mother even when she tries to go back in time. I think I could be wrong in that, but I think that is, I think it's... Which is dark. So
that should be a lesson to time travelers everywhere. You know, you can't undo everything in the past.
Well, if you fight Lavos too early and you die, you get the first of 12 different endings that says, "And the future refused to change," and you watch Lavos destroy the world.
I got that ending a couple times. It's actually pretty cool because you actually see like people in 1999 being like, "We're under attack. What do we do?" And they're like scrambling, and there's like a whole cutscene for it. So that's pretty cool. There's like, "We got multiple bogeys inbound on the radar," and it's like Lavos's needles bombing cities.
It's some 90s talk right there.
There are 12 to 15 endings in this game. There are some that have minor variations. There's 90 minutes of potential ending scenes in this game. So, like, the endings can range from the Reptites one that we talked about earlier to the Lavos one that we talked about. There's an ending in this game where, Chris mentioned it, where the female characters rate the looks of male characters in this game.
Good for them. Good for them. That's very progressive.
There's also, just in terms of progressive for a second, on a tangent, aside from Marl's, like, disappearance, there's no, like, damsel in distress in this game. It's not like there. JRPG trope is that there's some princess somewhere that you have to save. And, like, aside right. from the first, like, hour of this game, there's the women are all pretty empowered, including Isla and Luca and Marl.
Yeah, I was going to say that struck me at the beginning of this. Playing this game is that there's more female characters than male characters in the party. If you, I mean, like, one's a frog and one's a robot, but it's like Chrono and like his lady friends, basically.
Right.
And I thought that was cool. I mean, you start off with Luca and Marley or Marl, and they're your party for like the first 3-4 hours of this game. I feel like maybe not 4 hours, but early on.
Right.
And once Chrono is killed, I mean, Marl essentially becomes your party leader. Like, I mean, the story centers around. You know, and if you play the game without reviving Chrono, like, she is the main character, essentially, or closest thing to a main character in Chrono's absence.
Right. There's also an ending where you can interact with the directors of this game. That's called the dream ending, where you walk around and can talk to Sakaguchi and Yuji Horii and all the other people, and their like sprites are in the game. It's funny.
Yeah, that's the hardest ending to get.
I would say one of the things that makes this game work for me, and at the time period, I think probably you too, Chris, were thinking about this, is that, you know, there are only a handful of party members in this game, but because there's only a handful, they can really get into their background and tell these deep stories about these characters' backgrounds. Whereas I think at the time period, people were really looking for, and I don't know why, but like they really wanted like the raw number of party members to go like super high. So like Suikoden had 107 party members, and that was like a huge number. Chrono Cross
107.
Yeah, you can recruit.
Well, so every Suikoden game has it's the 107 or the 108 stars of destiny. That's the gimmick, is there's 108 or 107. I always forget which one it is.
But that's too many party members.
It's like a gimmick though. In Chrono Cross, there's 30.
There's 45.
It's 45.
Oh, yeah, 45 in Chrono Cross.
Yeah. See, this is why I stay away from JRPGs.
So, I think that one of this, it's funny, as you get older, you realize that some things are better left not done. And one of those things is just, you know, give me 4 or 5 party members, you know, 6, whatever, and let them tell a super interesting story. Because even like Final Fantasy VII, there's too many party members. You get like Kate Sith is like never drawn out. Red 13 is never really. There's like some stuff, but it's not. I want them to be more fully fleshed out, and I think this game does it in a really good way.
Right. That's, you know, that's, I mean, as the JRPG guy, that's like the appeal to me is like, it's, you play these long, long games that are supposed to be about like, you know, you think about where you started, and then when you hit the end of the game, you think about how your characters matured, what they experienced, what they went through. And I think when you have too many characters, it dilutes it. And, you know, Chrono Trigger keeping the party small and giving them all such like strong backstory. I think the only character in this game that doesn't really have that strong of a backstory is Isla. But you know, I think other than that, I think everybody else has a very good story arc. I don't think she really has too much of an arc. It's kind of left to like that kind of battle over like who's going to be like the village chief and stuff like that. But other than that, I think she kind of takes a backseat.
She's got her boy toy, Kino.
Yeah, that's comical.
Something. So, Chris, you played, or you're currently playing, Chrono Cross.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Chrono Cross that you've played a bit of it? The sequel, supposedly. But not really the sequel. It's weird. It's not really a sequel.
Kind of sequel, but like not really. Yeah. It's you know, it's okay. It's, you know, you can definitely tell that, like, you know, the Dream Team, quote unquote, is not involved with this game. Like, there's very little holdovers from the Dream Team, or there's not really any holdovers from the Dream Team. And I think this kind of segues into, like, I was going to do kind of like some wrap up kind of, I don't want to call it trivia, but just like some like kind of like final notes. You know, like there were some kind of dangling story threads left over from Chrono Trigger that, you know, people who worked on it like wanted to wrap up, and they did the Radical Dreamers visual novel or quasi-visual novel Satellaview game project, which kind of leads into Chrono Cross. And this is supposed to be kind of like the... It's supposed to be the wrapping up of the story threads from Chrono Trigger that becomes Chrono Cross. Kind of divorces itself from it. There is the overarching theme of Lavos, but, you know, from a gameplay standpoint, it's still cool. It's a little bit different. Like, they, you know, rather than having, like, your battles take place in the battlefield, you get sucked into a 3D environment, but there's nothing random. It's, you know, it's good, but again, it's just kind of like we were talking about, like, you know, I thought there was, like, 30-some-odd characters, and I realized there was 45. It's like, you know, I've already kind of hit points of that game where I was like, yeah, you know, this is kind of... The characters are being diluted because there's so many. And, you know, less is more in this sort of sense. And it's, I mean, it's good, but, you know, I find myself playing the game with Serge or Sergey and Kid always in my party because I go, all right, the story must center around them. And I don't want to swap them out to put other characters in.
What's the other main characters?
Well, there's the villain, Lynx, who becomes playable. There's the Harlequin, or Harley. You know, then the rest, I kind of feel like they're all... Like, I feel like that third party member is always interchangeable. I feel like it's really Sergey and Kid.
So, okay.
At least where I'm at in the game. Because I think I'm about halfway through, so...
So you mentioned that the DS version, they added a chapter onto that that explains Shala a little bit. From my understanding, Chrono Cross, the entire construction of that game is designed around answering the question, what happened to Shala in Chrono Trigger?
So maybe I'm not that far in the game, because Shala hasn't even been referenced once yet in the game. The Frozen Flame is referenced, which I know is tied to Lavos, but Shala has not been referenced at this point.
You'll get there.
Where I'm at. Okay.
But so also, what else did I... I was listening to a Retronauts episode about Chrono Cross, which came out recently, and it sounds absolutely fucking wild what happens in that game compared to this game. So not only is there...
Have you played it? Or
no, I just was listening to like the story, and like no one could discernibly say what the story was in that game because it goes across time and dimension.
So Sergey is, you know, it introduces parallel worlds, and we don't have to get too lost on Chrono Cross, but like it introduces parallel worlds, and he's dead in one and alive in another, and he has crossed over to the world where he is already dead. And apparently, so I know like Lynx, who seems like the initial villain of the game, has referred to him as the Chrono Trigger. And I was like, all right. I was like, well, I don't know like how this ends up. Like, I don't know what that means. Like, does he become the Chrono Trigger that's in Chrono Trigger? Which, funny that the game is called Chrono Trigger, but the actual Chrono Trigger, as we said, is like kind of just like a MacGuffin that kind of pops up like... for like an act the actual Chrono Trigger. But,
would you be upset?
So I don't know. No, don't spoil it for me because I don't want to know.
No, this is kind of, I think it's a minor thing in this game. Would you be upset if I told you a minor spoiler for the game?
No.
I believe Lynx is Serge's dad from another dimension.
Well, that's a fucking minor. That's... You're just ruining the Empire Strikes Back.
That seems like a big spoiler.
You just ruined the Empire Strikes Back. Here's where the Empire Strikes Back for a whole bunch of people.
Minor spoiler, but Bruce Willis was dead the whole time.
Anyway, we won't keep talking about Chrono Cross.
I think that's a minor part of the game. But he's also like a cat man, too. And he's also his dad somehow. And it's that game sounds wild.
All right, let's wrap up some things on Chrono Trigger before we get to the rankings. Because... Two things I want to mention. One was kind of a callback to something we talked about earlier, just about, again, the world building and how the dialogue changes. So, really quick, the Black Omen, which is the last, quote-unquote, dungeon of the game, which you can skip entirely if you want to. But, like, because you cause the Black Omen to be summoned in the medieval era, like, after it is summoned, it's just floating in the sky. And when you talk to people, like, in 1000 BC, or, 1080... And, Yeah, or when you talk to it, like, anybody after the medieval times, they don't even, like, they're not even perturbed by the big black fortress floating in the sky, because as far as they know, it's just been there for their entire life.
Oh, and yeah, so they don't care. Funny.
Yeah, which I think is a great little detail, like, that, like, sometimes, like, you'll, like, your characters will ask people about it, and you're like, well, I don't know, it's just always been there, so whatever, who cares? And then, like, but you can go to one mountain where there's one random imp character that's worshipping the Black Omen, and I thought that was great.
You can also beat it, like, 3 times, too, because if you beat it in the future, it's still there in the past. So if you beat it in 2300...
Yeah.
It's gone. If you beat it in the past, it's gone in the future, which is great.
But as we talked about, like, there's not really a need to grind, so, like, you don't really need to do that. But last, like, more like a little trivia thing that I just wanted to note is that the game was, the Super Nintendo cartridge was programmed to detect bootleg copies, and so where the scan, or however you would call it, kicks in, is when you go through whenever you try to travel through time, the game looks to see if you're playing a bootleg copy, and if it detects that you are, you never get out of the loop of the time travel.
Oh, really? Screen. That's funny. Yeah.
So that was my little piece of trivia I wanted to add to wrap this up.
So as we move into our rankings, our ranking discussion, where we're going to add it to our endless list, which is, as I said, 97 games long, from Super Mario 64 at number 1 all the way down to Jurassic Park Trespasser at number 97. I want to mention a couple things. So a couple points in this game's favor. This game is known as the originator of New Game Plus. So this game is the first game that had New Game Plus in it. So if you beat this game, Steve, you can keep all of your XP and all of your items and all of your money and start a new game. So that's how you access other endings by beating Lavos earlier.
Do you know how they came to develop the New Game Plus?
No.
So beta testers were playing the game, they would come back and they would say that they enjoyed the time travel element so much that they kind of wanted to go through different time periods in a different sort of way. Mm-hmm. And so that gave them the idea to do the New Game Plus, and thus unlocking the different endings and the different way to approach the game on multiple playthroughs.
Yeah, and then also I would say that this game is pretty manageable time to beat. It's 20 hours typically to beat this game.
Yeah, I'm only halfway through this game, but I think I'm going to play the rest of it and beat it. I've been enjoying it so far. It just kind of ran out of time, and I got distracted by other games, but I've liked it a lot so far, so I'm going to keep playing it, because I think I'm like 10 hours into the game, so I'm pretty much halfway.
The game is so good, too.
So as we get into this game, as we get into discussion of this list, just want to point out, so Steve mentioned earlier that you're currently playing through this game, you're halfway through this game. Chris, you've played this game, you said, like 15 times since 1995. I, on the other hand, first played this game, I think, like 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So I don't have any nostalgia for it. I've been slowly going through all of the SNES and PS1 RPGs because I love those things over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. And this was one of the ones that I got to. And this time I wasn't going to play it. I was going to play a couple hours, but I ended up playing the whole game because I really enjoyed it. I actually 100%ed this game when I played it. I went through every side quest. I did everything I could in this most recent playthrough. So,
wow, that's impressive, especially for a second playthrough, like only a few years later.
Right. And I was, I think I said this during the Last of Us podcast as well. Again, I wasn't planning on doing it. It just happened. Just got involved with it and I couldn't put it down. So that's where I am on it. In terms of our rankings, so we have a couple RPGs on our list. We have Dragon Quest at number 37. We have Final Fantasy VI at 24, Final Fantasy VII at 18, and Final Fantasy IV at number 10. Where does this game go in relation to these? Because for me, I think it goes above Final Fantasy IV.
Oh, yeah. This, you know...
So we're kicking off this conversation right at number 10 right now.
I don't know if I'm going to make a bold... I don't think this is a bold statement, but I think, you know, we're talking about games that, like, we all kind of nominated to be... Which should be close to the top, if not the top, of the endless list. I mean, you know, obviously it's well whatever, documented, I guess, in this podcast that I am the JRPG guy. I mean, this, to me personally, this is a number one game to me on this list. I don't expect you guys to say the same thing. I think you may have arguments to put it high in the top 10, but, you know, I know for me, this is like the game of games to me. You know, what I think of, what I like, what I enjoy, what I have fun with. Like, but I think, you know, I think one thing I would say to consider with this is that, you know, this is a podcast that we're doing where we just said so many glowing things about this game. It's actually kind of hit me as we talked about this game. We not at any point said anything negative about any of the, you know, any chunks of the game that we have to go through. We didn't say, oh yeah, like I love this game except for that awful part or this part or whatever. Like, I can't say that about a lot of games. We didn't really have that. I'm sure if we really thought about it, we could probably find something.
I can give you one token negative thing right now that always bothers me. It takes a little too long for the combat to start every time you get into an encounter.
Yep.
Just like 2 seconds too long. And I'm just like,
is it okay?
Yeah.
That's all I can come up with.
I feel like that is probably perhaps fixed in the port that I that
the
I played
port?
But yeah, but I
put, oh yes. Actually, yeah. Yes, then that kind of goes into another thing. I'm playing this on the PS3, so it's like the PS1 version, and I wish I was playing it in a handheld mode. I think I would have beaten this game if I'd played it
we didn't touch on that. The PS1 version and later the DS port, they added anime cutscenes that didn't exist in the original, but also with those PS1 ports, you also get loading times, just like you did. That was released with Final Fantasy IV on a compilation disc, and that's like
I could have seen.
That's the
Final Fantasy.
It was cool. It was cool to see
loading times.
Final Fantasy V, by the way. It's
Sorry. Yeah, it's 4 and 6, then 5 in this. So I have but they all suffer from loading times that didn't exist previously.
But the loading times on the combat and the PS1 version, which is the only one that's really accessible now, because every other one, the Super Nintendo one, is like $150 right now if you want to buy it on eBay.
Yeah, well, the DS port you can play on iOS systems, and that's actually like what I did for this. I played the DS port on my iPhone with my PS4 controller as my Bluetooth controller. So, but I wish I could have just been playing this.
I was just saying, I wish I could have just been playing this on Switch and like watching like TV or something like while I did I would crush this game if I had been able to do that. Solely play it on my big screen TV, like with the PS3, you know, there's time constraints on when I can use that TV.
Put this game on Switch. Put it on Switch. Why is all the Final Fantasies from PS1 on Switch, but not Chrono Trigger? What are you doing, Square? Square Enix,
Square always seems to look over the Chrono series. But the point I was going to make is that, you know, I'm the RPG guy on this podcast. I mean, Mike, you obviously like RPGs too, but Steve, I know you're not like an RPG guy, and it's like here we are talking about a game.
Not a JRPG guy.
Let's clarify that.
You're a Western RPG guy.
Yeah, but like we're talking Fallout, about a game that
Skyrims, etc.
Exactly. Yeah,
we're talking about a game though that has, regardless of what your preferred game is, this is a game that seems like it appeals to all sorts of gamers and their gaming backgrounds, and even if this is not like a genre that you normally read into, like this is one that you could play and, you know, get sucked into and have a good time with. So I think that is really that's the argument I'm making in its favor. It's like it's mass and cross appeal to a genre that I think is usually kind of, you know, either you like it or you don't like it, and there's like not an in between. And I think this is one of those rare games that hits that in between without sacrificing what makes that genre great.
So, I mean, this is my favorite JRPG that I've played. And keep in mind, I haven't played a ton of JRPGs. I've played a bit of them. I think I have a whole PS1 RPGs outside of the Final Fantasy series. So, like, I need to play, like, Lunar. I need to play the Suikoden series and those games. The Xeno series, I need to play more. But from the JRPGs that I've played, this is my favorite JRPG. This might be my favorite RPG. I'm pretty sure it is my favorite RPG of all time, just in general. So that's where I am with it. In terms of where I would put it, personally, I would put it either at 3 or 4. That's where I would put it.
I was going to lobby to you guys to consider putting it in the Symphony of the Night to Mario 64 range. And actually, the more I look at this list,
one,
the more
one through
I
go, three.
yes.
How humble.
But I don't think that's off base though. And this is a different point. The more games we play, the more we get away from it. The more I keep looking at this and going, like, man, Metal Gear Solid might have gone above Mario 64, but that's, I don't know. Whatever. But anyway,
I just replayed Super Mario 64 when it came out for the 3D All-Stars, and I 100%ed that game, and I loved that game, playing it. And I see on Twitter, and it's funny because when Super Mario 3D All-Stars came out, there was a lot of people talking about it again and saying that it was bad, and I'm like, I can't. The way the movement happens and how they do level design is so good in that game. And the fact that it was like the first 3D game is like, it's just so mind blowing to me.
I feel like all the criticism I've heard about that game is boiled down to the camera, basically.
Right,
it's
right.
Like the camera feels clunky and you can't like fully 360 it. You're kind of like doing it in quarters as you go around.
Right. The camera if you think about the camera in that game, it's actually a thing. So you have it's the Lakitu
yeah, it's a guy,
is supposed to present. So like when it gets into corners and stuff, it like hits corners because it's an actual camera that's sitting behind you.
And they were also, you know, like inventing the 3D camera at the time too. So like give them a little slack, you know. Like
I mean, amazing game. It's just, you know, Metal Gear Solid's game. I had never played until apparently around October of 2019. Looking at the spreadsheet, that was the first time I ever played it, and I still find myself reflecting on Metal Gear Solid, going, fuck, that was really good. And I'm pumped over doing Metal Gear Solid 2. And I don't have that with Super Mario 64. I do have that with Chrono Trigger, because even though I have beaten the game like about a dozen times, or more, about 10, like even like replaying it for the pod for like the first time in years, like I find myself going like, oh man, like if I wasn't actually playing all these other games for this podcast, I would probably be like on like my 8th new game plus run on Chrono Trigger right now. But, Duty calls on It's So Bad. So I didn't.
I get more enjoyment, I think, out of Symphony of the Night. I would say that the story is probably better in Chrono Trigger, and I think it's just, I think the action and the gameplay in Castlevania Symphony of the Night is just so superb.
Can we start with agreeing goes above Legend of Zelda? Can we start there?
Yeah, I think you guys, when I was looking at this list before we got in here too, I kind of looked at it and I was like, I feel like this is either going to be 3 or 4 on this list. It's either going to jump over Castlevania Symphony of the Night or just land right under it. And it's tough, like the top 10, like, I don't know, some of these games I love, some of these games I haven't played before, some of these games I like, but I like understand their historical importance to the gaming, you know, canon. Yeah, I think I kind of agree with Mike. Like, this definitely has a better story than Castlevania Symphony of the Night. Symphony of the Night is just like, you know, it's very straightforward. It's like you got to kill the bad guy in the castle. But the gameplay in that is like much more up my alley. Like, I like the Metroidvania style a lot more. I like that kind of like action combat platforming style more than I like the turn-based RPG combat. But I also, this was the best probably RPG combat I've ever played in a game. And I like time travel stories a lot, so like that, you know, that was going strong for this. So there was a lot to really, really like about Chrono Trigger. So I would personally give the nod to Castlevania Symphony of the Night at number 3 and put this maybe at number 4, because it sounds like we're kind of zeroing in on there. But I also haven't beaten the game, so I kind of defer to you guys a little bit to hash this out.
You know what's interesting about, and we kind of touched on this when we were talking about the time travel stuff, like a lot of games, time travel would just be like, okay, you're hopping in between different eras, right? You're going from this era to this era and you're accomplishing some task. This game, you do that, but you leave markers behind and you change the environment and you can change history. There's one quest where you, have to go back, and there's a guy you talk to who you need something from. He steals a rock from a cave.
Oh, Toma the Explorer.
Yeah, well, is it that guy?
You meet his lineage. You meet his lineage as you go. Are you talking about like where it's like the rainbow shell?
No. So the Sunstone. At one point.
Oh yeah. Sorry. That's what I meant. Yeah, it's Toma the Explorer. Okay. You meet his family as you go on.
So they're
always in bars drinking.
But there's one part where somebody steals, I think it's a mayor of some random town, steals the sunstone from the cave, and you have to go and get it from him, and he's like, I'm not going to give you that shit. He's like, it's in my safe. You're never going to get it. So you go from 1000 AD to 600 AD, and you go back in time, and you have to buy a piece of jerky and give it to his like ancestors. And because you were, and she's like, I'll pay you for it. And if you say no to the payment and you just give it to them, she's like, oh, you're so charitable. And then when you go into the future, he's like, sure, I'll give you the sunstone. I found it, but I don't really need it. Because he was taught to be charitable by his ancestors. So yeah, everybody down the line was taught that because of that one specific moment, they changed who they were.
The dialogue change in that is awesome too, because when you talk to like the kids in the house before you change the past, the kid's like, I hate my father.
My father's so like selfish. He's a fat asshole.
then you go back in time, change history. The kid's like, I love my father. He's so kind.
So they do that.
Yeah, this game.
They do that shit all the time.
Yeah, this game, like on that thread, this game made me appreciate, like, games that I really, really love are games like KOTOR, Knights of the Old Republic, and Mass Effect. Like, games where, like, your actions have consequences in the world and can change how people feel about you and change outcomes in the game, and you can get multiple endings. And playing through this and knowing that that was, like, you know, this was the starting point for a lot of that storytelling and that kind of, like, world-building down the line of games that I love. Like, I'm not the biggest JRPG fan, but I like RPGs, and just like seeing them do this in 1995, and then like knowing and not having really known that at the time when I was playing Mass Effect or when I was playing Knights of the Old Republic or these other games where, like, you know, your decisions really have an impact on the world. It's very cool to see the origins of that in this, you know, JRPG 1995 Super Nintendo format. And how that influenced games down the line, like in a huge, huge way.
We didn't touch on it either, but the first trial is like, when I first played it 4 years ago, I was like not that impressed. But if you were playing this game in 1995 and you get to the first trial where they're bringing up what you did at the fair, it's like, it would be mind blowing to me. Like, they knew that I had to save this cat in order to be not guilty. They knew that if I ate this sandwich, it was going to make me guilty. And that influenced this decision to make me guilty in this trial. It's a crazy thing for a game in 1995.
Yeah. And you felt like you're negotiating a little bit in there too. Like, you're like, they're asking you questions. You're like, no, I didn't do that. No, that's not the way it happened. And then like, they're making decisions as you respond.
Cool. It's worse. The worst thing about that too, is they're like, was it your fault or was it Marl's fault? And like, they don't give you an option. It's either your fault or you're going to blame her. It's like, okay, this is like authoritarian law here.
I think I blamed Marl in that part too, and like actually got the vote on my side. Like, whoever the magistrate or whatever, like, joined me. And I was like, "That's what happened." She ran into me. Like, I don't know what to say.
the last thing I'll say about like the time travel part that I think, Steve, you were kind of touching, or which you said kind of made me think of, is that I feel like a lot of games that have the time travel elements too, it's like you kind of go to a period of time like once, maybe twice at the most, and it's like, you know, then you're kind of done. Whereas like, this is a game you're repeatedly going to the past, repeatedly going to the future at different points. Like, you've already changed the past a couple times, and then like, you might find yourself doing a side quest later changing the past even yet again for like a fourth or a fifth time. And I think that's a really like unique way to approach it, because I feel like a lot of games since like don't really treat time travel like in that sort of way. It's kind of like a little bit of like a gimmick where you're like, oh, let's pop back to this period for like once or twice and then pop out.
Yeah, time travel, you can fall into a trap with time travel where it's either like too simple and rudimentary and it's like, what, that's not, they didn't think that through, or they think it through like way, way, way too much, and it just like all these like logical inconsistencies come up and you're like, that's like a Christopher Nolan thing or something. It's like, you went way too deep into way into the deep end here, and like, this doesn't make enough sense. And this kind of like threads the needle in between both, where it like thinks about the implications of time travel but not so much that like you're gonna get in trouble or like, you know, like it detracts from the story, you know, just like,
except for when nice you balance. Turn everybody into reptiles, timey wimey wibbly wobbly.
So I mean, I could put this at 3 or 4. Either way, I would be fine with it. Just as we have this discussion, I don't know.
I think, you know, I enjoyed Symphony of the Night greatly. I just kind of feel like for what we have all just kind of discussed, I think a little bit more meat in the bone with Chrono Trigger, but at the same time too, we are comparing it to a game like Symphony of the Night that did pretty much launch an entire genre after its release. But I think game versus game, I kind of feel like there's a little bit more.
Yeah, it's like pinnacle of the genre versus, or like accessible pinnacle of the genre versus like the game that launched a new genre out of an old genre. I don't know. It's interesting cross point
there. I think Chrono Trigger ages better. I think especially from hearing how you guys, like Mike, I didn't realize you didn't play it until like a couple of years ago, and Steve, you're playing it now. I don't think
Chrono Trigger ages better than Castlevania.
No, Night. I really? Disagree with that.
Absolutely
too, yeah.
not. No.
There are games that are coming out now trying to do what Castlevania did in 1997 that aren't nailing it. True.
And there are not games that are coming out now that do what Chrono Trigger does. But there are no games coming out today that feel like Chrono Trigger.
Yeah. Well, I'd say play Cosmic Star Harrowing is an indie game that's kind of like Chrono Trigger. That's a fun game, but not a great game. And it's a very good game. I would say play that if you like this game. That was a weird plug for a game that we'll probably never talk about.
Cosmic Star Heroine?
Yeah. It's usually really
on,
good.
It's on sale for like a buck usually. I might.
Oh, it's so worth it. Yeah. It's only like 8-9 hours, but like it is very, very Chrono Trigger-esque and a very, very good game. It doesn't make any bones about that it's like a Chrono Trigger like worship type game. It's good. If you can get it for like a buck or $2, totally worth it. I mean, I think full price, I think it was like $8-9. I digress. But, yeah, I mean...
Chris, where do you want to put this? Between three? Do you want to put it at three? Should we put it at three?
I kind of want to put it at three.
Yeah. I kind of want to keep Castlevania at three, but that's just me.
Mike, you didn't save Luca's mother's legs.
I didn't.
You have to do the right thing and put it at three. That would make Luca feel a little bit better about not saving her mother's legs.
I feel like because of how influential Castlevania is on its creating its genre, Chris, I'm going to kill you for joining the what do you call those people? The contrarians?
I believe in
the dissenters.
We have the dissenters. The dissenters.
For joining the dissenters stable, I'm going to have to put this at four. Because
but what about Luca's mother's legs? You know? And what about, you can't play Symphony of the Night and, like, you know, change time and history like you can in Chrono Trigger. And what about Frog? What about Frog?
Yeah, but what about Alucard? What about Dracula? Vlad Dracula? I mean, come on.
Oh, Richter. Yeah. Listen. Come on. I think Frog is... Frog's just so much more appealing than all those folks. I mean, Robo, he had to beat up his own, he had to kill his own girlfriend.
I feel like Chrono Trigger is where it's at. Largely, the combat's good, but I think it holds up as well as it does because of the story and the characters. But I do feel like the combat I like it, but it's something that not everybody's gonna like. Whereas I feel like Castlevania Symphony of the Night, because its combat so tight, it naturally lended itself to be like a formula for an indie game, but that's because it did it so well back in the day. So I think that this, like, in reality, like without my biases going into it, I really think this game is number four.
So I'll agree to put it at four, but I want to say, Steve, I think if you complete this game between now and the great re-rank, that maybe we have a little discussion about where it lands.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you can always travel back from the future to now.
That's
to change
right.
the past of this game. You can perhaps re-rank
That's
this
right.
game at some point.
I am
but I'm saving my re-rank vote for... I'm saving my re-rank vote for Dishonored. I mean, that's just going to be...
I don't really have a Tiger game for the great re-rank, but... no, I'm good with going at four, but... maybe I'll revisit the re-rank. I feel like I am Chrono getting wiped out by Lavos right now. Just kidding.
For you, number four game.
Number four all time.
I'm just joshing. But I guess we haven't even said it, that this is episode 100.
Oh,
Chrono Trigger is episode 100.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger is episode number 100, not the 100th entry. Episode number
right,
100.
Episode 100, yep.
Yes.
Clear distinction there.
Congratulations to everybody for making it to episode number 100.
How far we've come. We started with Final Fantasy. Wait, was Final Fantasy VI the first episode? Or
I think Final Fantasy IV was. No, so I think the first one I did was Contra Hardcore.
Okay.
And then we started with Final Fantasy VI.
Yes, that was the first one you and I did.
Yes.
Which was 2, I think.
Yes. It was not. So it was the number one game for a while.
Though, this officially pushes Final Fantasy IV out of the top 10. I did it to my own boy.
Yeah, you did it to yourself. Hooray! Travel back through time to thwart yourself.
Listen, still my favorite game of all time, Final Fantasy IV, but that's nostalgia goggles.
Well, congratulations to Chrono Trigger. You are the number 4 game on the Endless List, our 98th entry. And yeah, thanks guys for coming on. Thank you for being part of countless hundred episodes that we have in our library currently. And we have 2 more games until we get to our 100th game on the Endless List. We have next week we'll be doing Assassin's Creed Black Flag. Is that correct? Am I reading my notes correct?
What?
That's a best of the best game. Just kidding. It's one of the
everything
best
is permitted. Nothing is forbidden.
Will it be the best of the best? Will it be the last game? Will it go lower than The Last of Us?
That's true. The Last of Us is the worst best game that we've discussed here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's 19. Yeah.
19.
So that's something you have to keep an eye out, listener, for our next one. Will
it's interesting because I kind of consider the top 20 games to be the best games, and The Last of Us is in. It's going to get knocked out of the top 20, isn't it? Yeah, it is.
Well, you think Assassin's Creed Black Flag is going to go above The Last of Us?
Oh, I guess that's true. Yeah. Well, I was just considering like 2 more best games, but yeah, I guess. Well, we'll find out on the next episode.
Yes. So stay tuned for that. You can follow us at It's So Bad Pod on the Twitter. itssobadpod@gmail.com is the email address, and I should really say this at the top of the episode and not at the very last minute, but nevertheless, thank you, Steve, and thank you, Chris, for joining me this week.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Hey, and we'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks, guys.